You know, they've got a 1-year race against this massive wall of obstruction from Team Trump.
It'll be very interesting when they hold public hearings, and then that comparison to the Watergate public hearings that so many watched at the time. But I wanted to ask you, Will Bunch, about what former Trump trade advisor Peter Navarro said on MSNBC yesterday when he was interviewed by Ari Melber. He outlined his support last year for what he called the Green Bay Sweep, a plan to overturn the election results in 6 states.
The plan was simply this. We had over 100 congressmen and senators on Capitol Hill ready to implement the sweep. The sweep was simply that. We were going to challenge the results of the election in the 6 battleground states. They were Michigan, Pennsylvania, Georgia, Wisconsin, Nevada.
Do you realize you are describing a coup?
No, I totally reject many of your premises there.
So there you have it, Will. I'm wondering if you could respond to this. Jamie Raskin, one of the key members of the Select Committee, has responded, the congressman from Maryland, and said that you have this very unusual situation where maybe the Trump supporters outside and their violence with this insurrection subverted what they wanted to accomplish, their allies wanted to accomplish, Trump wanted to accomplish inside, what Peter Navarro just laid out.
Well, yeah, I mean, there. When you look back at it, there's so many different ways that things could have broken on January 6th as opposed to what happened. But, you know, I think the bottom line, I mean, I think Ari Melber nailed it. I mean, there's no other word for what they're talking about here other than a coup. You know, the idea was that if you could block the certification in enough states, and I guess those 6 states would have done it, then you would have taken Biden under 270 electoral votes. Then the claim would be that, well, you're throwing the election into the House under the constitutional procedure. And the way the House vote goes, which is not by individual member but by state delegations, Republicans actually still control the majority of the delegations. And so Republicans could have used that mechanism to impose a Trump presidency. So the thing is, I don't think that plan could have worked without the cooperation of Mike Pence. And so, you know, I mean, there were 3 or 4 incredible hinge points about January 6th and the failure to convince Pence, who had been such a compliant vice president for 4 years, to go along is one of the hinge points. I think Mark Milley and the Pentagon realizing the threats. And don't forget the January 3rd letter from every living former defense secretary, from Dick Cheney to the Democratic ones, warning about the military getting involved on January 6th, because they knew that something was afoot and they were terrified of the possibilities. So, but I think this talk about the Green Bay sweep just shows the high level of planning that was going on here. And let's not forget, it's a felony to disrupt the operations of Congress. And I think that's something that the January 6th committee is really honing in on. Was there a criminal conspiracy to disrupt Congress from doing its job on January 6th? And if so, who was involved in that? You know, obviously, Trump advisors were involved. You know, was the president himself involved? You know, to again, for the umpteenth time, get back to Watergate. You know, what did the president know, and when did he know it? I mean, I think there's going to be some real drama behind these hearings when they go public. They may be in prime time, I'm hearing now, which would be quite a political event in 2022.
Well, we want to thank you so much for being with us. Will Bunch, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, national columnist at the Philadelphia Inquirer. We'll link to his pieces at democracynow.org. A very happy birthday to Clara Ibarra, and a belated happy birthday to Dennis McCormick. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Noreen Sheikh, Maria Tarasena, Tommy Warrenoff, Trina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamari Astudio, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Honey Masood, Mary Conlon, our general manager, Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Becca Staley, John Randolph, Paul Powell, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Nogueira, Hugh Grand, Dennis Moynihan, David Prude, and Dennis McCormick. Remember, wearing a mask is an act of love, preferably an N95. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
concerned with your health and the new USDA organic product standards, WRCT Pittsburgh would like to inform you that all RDJs are genetically modified to bring you best music.
You're listening to Away With Words, the show about language and how we use it. I'm Grant Barrett.
And I'm Martha Barnett. We heard from Heidi Hebron Marshall, who writes, I have a job being a fake patient for medical students taking exams. It's a very interesting and fun job, and it's especially interesting now that the students have to give us physical exams over Zoom. When the students start asking, have you had fevers, chills, night sweats, headaches, joint pain, etc., I always think, here comes the laundry list. And that got me to thinking, what on earth is a laundry list? I definitely assume it's a long written out list, but why would you need to write out a list, especially if someone else was doing your laundry for you?
So why would she list a bunch of symptoms and call it a laundry list? There's no laundry on there.
Correct. And the reason is that it goes back to a time when people of a certain class sent their laundry out to be cleaned. And, you know, it's usually associated with things that are everyday or routine kind of drudgery. It's not usually a positive connotation, is it? I mean, you don't really...
No, there's really a little bit of a negative strike to it, right?
Yeah.
Laundry list of complaints is a common way to put it.
Yeah, as opposed to compliments.
Mm-hmm. Right. You know, you don't have a laundry list of compliments.
So, Heidi, thank you for your work. Somebody's going to be grateful that you're doing that.
If you've got a question about an everyday expression or word that suddenly strikes you as inexplicable, give us a call, 877-929-9673, or share your language stories or thoughts to us in email, words@waywardradio.org. Hello, welcome to Away With Words.
Hey, this is Daniel from Wilmington.
Hi, Daniel from Wilmington, Delaware or North Carolina?
North Carolina, the cooler one.
Cooler one. Well, welcome, cool dude. What can we do for you?
Hey, Daniel.
You know, this weird word situation that I always thought was strange and still haven't been able to get to the bottom of is in English, we call our morning meal breakfast, like breaking a fast, ending a fast. And in Spanish, the word desayuno is like the exact same thing. If you break down the word desayuno, you got that prefix des, and then ayuno is the word for fast. It's like to undo a fast. And so I thought that was weird. It's like, how do you have two different languages come up with this same kind of literal meaning for their first meal of the day?
Whoa.
That's weird.
Yeah.
You guys know the answer? I thought maybe there was like a foreign exchange student or like a foreign exchange monk from Spain showed up in England and was like, hey, you know, we call this meal ending a fast. You guys should do that. And the monks were like, that's a great idea. And then they started
right
doing
on,
it.
Yeah. The Erasmus program for monks.
Oh, this is great. Well, you're right on track. I mean, this has happened in more than two languages, as a matter of fact. If you go back to Latin, the Latin word that means to fast is related not only to ayunar in Spanish, to fast, but also the word in French. And so you get déjeuner in French and desayuno in Spanish, meaning breakfast, literally to break the fast. How cool is that?
It's pretty cool.
Yeah, the Latin word for empty, jejunus, it gives us other cool words too, like the word jejun in English, which means sort of dull or insipid. It comes from that Latin word that literally meant fasting or hungry. It means empty.
Cool. I feel a little smarter.
Well, I don't know. Did we tell you anything you didn't know?
Some of those other Latin words I didn't know, like the jejun thing.
Yeah.
But we got to chat with you, and that was a delight for us, so we appreciate it, Daniel.
Yeah.
Well, thank you. It was fun being on the show.
All right. Take care now. Be well.
All right. Bye.
Thanks, Daniel. Bye-bye.
Help us fill out those corners of our minds. What are the words that you know in other languages for having breakfast? 877-929-9673. Email words@waywardradio.org.
Remember that call we had a while back, Grant, that so many people responded to? It was the one where someone was asking if there's a word in English that's the drink equivalent of feed. You know, you feed somebody, but what's the verb for giving a drink to somebody? Remember that?
That's right.
So many responses.
Yeah, a lot of people said you libate them, but that sounds almost obscene.
Yeah, and people were really, really struggling with that. Some people suggested embeverage, which I kind of like, but it's a little fancy. And everybody was wondering, well, is there a language that does have a verb like that? And in fact, there is. It's Hebrew. I learned that from Kitty Keller, who's a United Methodist pastor in Pennsylvania. And the verb is lahashkot, which means to give drink to. And you find it, for example, in Genesis, where Rebecca gives somebody water to drink and then also waters the camels. It's the same thing.
Okay, great. So we're going to borrow that right into English right away.
Sure.
Yeah, I don't know how you would conjugate that in English. I lahashkoted my guest.
Yeah, come on over and I'll lahashkot you.
We're lahashkoting here. Grab one. Grab one out of the fridge. No, I don't think that works.
877-929-9673. Hello, you have a way with words.
Hi, my name's Katie, and I'm a college professor calling from San Diego.
Well, welcome, Katie.
Hi, Katie. What's up?
Hi. So as a college professor, I get a little bit more exposure than I would for someone my age to what the kids are saying these days. And I've noticed them using the phrase low-key in kind of an unusual way. So I had always thought of low-key as kind of a adjective, like you might describe a party as low-key or a laid-back person as low-key. But the students now seem to be using it more like an adverb. So like, I'm low-key crushing on that guy from my statistics class, or I was low-key lost in lecture today. And I've just kind of been wondering, you know, when did people start using it this way? And does it mean, like, secret? Like it's something they're kind of embarrassed to admit? Or does it still retain any of that, like, mildness? Like, is low-key bombing a test worse than or better than totally bombing a test? So I've just been wondering about that.
Oh, fantastic. This is good. So you're very observant. I like that. How long do you think you've been hearing this from your students?
Probably actually just starting this year. At the beginning of the fall is when I first started noticing it, although I suppose it could have been around for longer.
It has been. I can find examples of it on Twitter back to 2008, if you can believe that.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, but you've described low-key in exactly the way it's being used, and you even hinted at one of the other ways it's being used, and I'll talk about that in a second, that's a little less common. So there are two different collections of college slang, one from UCLA by Pamela Monroe and her students, and one from the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, from Connie Ebley and her students, and they both have recorded multiple instances of low-key being used more or less like you describe it. The UCLA collection has low-key, and they gloss it, meaning they just kind of basically define it as kind of. He was low-key hitting on me, or I was low-key mad at her, or she low-key looks like Angelina Jolie. Those are the examples they give. And then the Chapel Hill collection from Connie Ebley and her students start recording it in their collections in 2013, and they define it as with diminished feeling or intensity. Low key, her haircut looks like a hamster stuck in a blow dryer. So they use it there kind of as a sentence tag to put a hedge on something that's really negative, to kind of diminish the negative effect of something that you have said or that you're about to say. Another example is, I low-key want to go to a cookout. I mean, I kind of want to go. I have a slight inclination to go to a cookout.
Yeah, my 20-year-old stepson uses low-key in a way that's different from how I'm used to hearing it. And I've also heard from my younger improv buddies, Allison, and I asked her about this, and she said that to her, low-key means you're interested in something, but you didn't really expect to be drawn to it, or you're interested in something, but not really enthusiastic enough to actively pursue it. Like, I've been low-key looking at Crocs. They look kind of cool.
Oh, yeah. Oh, that cool. Makes sense. So you're right. Katie, when you say that it's an adverb and it modifies either an adjective or a verb in a way that it really plays off the normal meaning of low-key, which is not elaborate or showy, or it's muted or restrained. And the original low-key comes from photography. It's about the way that you present present a photograph as muted or as a kind of a moody look to it. A low-key photograph has a kind of a almost noirish, kind of a dusk or early morning look to it.
Wow, that's really cool. I didn't know that's where it came from, and I didn't realize how much nuance there was to it. Very cool.
And
thanks so much.
We'd love it if you would be our field reporter and report back to us some other things that you learned from your students.
Please bring back the farther we get away from college.
Yeah. When I was in my 30s, I felt like I could fake it. Now that I'm in my 50s, I just don't feel like I can fake it.
Well, I'll keep an ear out. Thank you so much.
All right. Take care. Be well.
Bye-bye.
Well, we talk about slang and word histories and grammar and all kinds of things on this show, and we love to talk with you. You can do that by calling us 877-929-9673 or send us an email. That address is words@waywardradio.org. Fahrenheit 451 is Ray Bradbury's most famous work, and it's about a dystopian future where books are banned and burned, of course. And the title refers to the temperature at which book paper catches fire and burns. What I didn't know until recently is that this book, published in 1953, included a run of 200 copies that were actually bound in asbestos.
That is amazing. Where would they find those? I guess those would be rare and prized in collectors'
hands. Funny you should say that. Yeah. They're at least $10,000. They usually go for between $10,000 and $20,000. So you can find these online, but I can't imagine that they're legal.
No. Well, I don't know about legal, but there's certainly something you don't want to lick.
Yeah. Yeah, I would think you would want to pay to get rid of them, but what do I know?
But a book about book burning certainly is a curiosity to begin with. And then one that happens to be such a great work on top of it is another plus. And then you do a stunt like that. Well, right away, you're talking about something even better.
Yeah. Yeah, it's made me want to go back and read that. So I just might.
877-929-9673.
This show's about language examined through family, history, and culture. Stay tuned.
You're listening to Away with Words, the show about language and how we use it. I'm Grant Barrett.
And I'm Martha Barnett. And joining us now is our quiz guy, Mr. John Chinesky.
Hello, Martha. Hello, Grant. It's so great,
John,
to hear your voices again.
Hey.
I'm eager to play with you. I've got a game with me today that I hope you'll like. It's based on an online game called Google Feud, which you may have heard of. In Google Feud, you're presented with the start of a Google search string, and you have to guess how Google's predictive search feature offers to complete it. For example, if I enter, what is the tallest, ... Google would predict building in the world, and also mountain in the world, and building in NYC, in that order, among others, usually with the most popular at the top. Now, I'll give you the start of a Google search string. You tell me what Google would offer to complete it. All I need is for you to pick one of the top 9 or 10 answers or so, and I'll let each of you have an answer so we can get as many answers as we can. Okay?
Okay.
All right.
Great. Let's go. Here's the first one. First Google search string. Where are my...
glasses?
Glasses not on there.
Car keys.
Keys is actually fifth. Yes.
Oh, keys? Huh.
Where are my keys? People Google to figure out where their keys are. Yes.
I hope that works. That'd be wonderful.
I hope so, too. I'll try it myself. Any other guesses?
Where are my packages?
Where
are my deliveries?
No, that's similar ones on here. The first one is, where are my Google Photos? There's also some other good ones are, where are my kidneys?
I was going to say parts of the body.
There you go. Where are my lymph nodes? And similar to keys, where are my AirPods?
Oh.
Okay.
Yeah.
Here's the next one. How do you use a...
It's hard to use that people would Google. So they already know how to use a computer enough to Google.
I bet that could be a question, though.
That's a good guess. Not on here, though.
Mm-hmm. How to use a slow cooker.
Ooh.
There's one on here that is coffee related.
Oh. How to use an espresso machine?
Ooh.
No?
It's how to use a French press.
Oh. Ooh,
okay. Good one.
Any how other do guesses? There's one on here that is grammar writing related.
How do you use a thesaurus?
No.
A spell checker?
No.
A dictionary?
It's how to use a semicolon.
Oh.
Don't.
Here are a few of the other ones. Now, this, of course, is actually giving us a good insight into what you guys want to learn how to use.
Yeah, right.
Number one is, how do you use a bidet? How do you use a protractor? And how do you use a fire extinguisher? Which... you should really know how to use a fire extinguisher, really.
Before you have to Google it.
Yes, exactly. If you're Googling it and it's warm, you should, just get out of there. Here's the last one. What is bigger than the...
What is bigger than the moon?
Moon's not on here, but...
Sun.
The sun is on here. Number two.
What is bigger than the...
Earth?
Universe?
Universe is number one. People want to know
Seriously? What's
bigger than the universe. Yeah.
Wow.
How about that?
Yeah. The other answers are, what is bigger than the Milky Way? And what's bigger than the solar system? And what's bigger than the blue whale?
No bread box in there?
No bread box. No.
Huh.
But nothing is as big as the love I have for you guys and the way you went through that quiz. Thank you so much.
That
was
sweet.
Awesome.
Wow, that was a real mind expander, John.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, Google doesn't know all, and you can Google and get a million results. But if you want a good result, and you want arbiters and judges of what quality language answers are, call Away with Words, 877-929-9673. Or email Martha and me, words@waywardradio.org, and talk to us on Twitter at WAYWORD. Hello, you have Away with Words.
Hi, my name's Bethany. I'm calling from Ithaca, New York.
Hi, Bethany. Welcome to the show.
My question is, I was looking for a word that means to feel at the same time just desperately lonely, but also absolutely reveling in your solitude.
Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Well, sure. Well, I posed the question to my friends. I have a lot of friends who have degrees in English and linguistics and, who speak different languages. And just for the concept of the idea of feeling these two very different things, feeling so incredibly horridly lonely, but also just like really happy to be alone. And no one could come up with anything, so they suggested that I coin a word. So I did. And the word I coined is dicotyllosthymia. That's dicotyllosthymia. And I got there from dichotomy, the dico for dichotomy, the dichotomy of feeling very, happy, but also very depressed and lonely. And the solace from solitude, because that's what the dichotomous feeling is about. And then since we're talking about feelings and English likes to beat up other languages to steal from them, I stole the anasthemia from Greek, the themia, mm-hmm. So dicotyllosthymia. And I don't know.
That's a really good explanation. Yeah. Sounds like a well-made word. The feeling that you're describing reminds me of breaking up with someone who's bad for you, where you really miss the relationship, but you know you needed to get rid of them.
Yeah, it is like that. You're right.
And Bethany, I appreciate your reaching for Greek here, of course. It's often difficult to bring Greek into English and have it be, I don't know, I find it hard to describe feelings with Greek roots. Somehow it feels kind of clinical to me. And so I guess I'm reaching for something from Anglo-Saxon, you know, that sort of more kind of earthy language. I mean, I'm just making this up. I mean, something like gladlorn, you know, sort of like lovelorn, but gladlorn.
Oh, that's nice.
Or
forlorn and glad. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you might enjoy
kind of like despair and respair.
Yeah. Like despair and respair. I'm also thinking you might enjoy going and reading some Anglo-Saxon poetry in translation. There's some really great stuff. There's one old poem called The Wayfarer and another called The Wanderer and another called The Seafarer. And they just really viscerally, I think, connote loneliness. And I'm just wondering if there's something from Anglo-Saxon, anhaga win. Anhaga is solitary and win is happiness.
I've got one more for you, Bethany. And this is from Will Gelbert's book, Wordwise. This book just came out. And he's got a section in here for these supposedly untranslatable words. Of course, there's no such thing as an untranslatable word. There's hard or difficult to translate words, but it might take a paragraph rather than a single word. This word is a German word, Waldeinsamkeit, and it means basically forest loneliness. It's a literary word, basically woodland solitude. You're in the forest without other people, but you're not alone because you're connected to nature.
Oh, I love that. How do you spell that?
Waldeinsamkeit. Yeah, and I got that from Will Gelbert's book, Wordwise. Waldeinsamkeit.
That sounds a lot like it.
I like all our suggestions.
It's more about the intersection between these feelings, right?
Mm-hmm.
Right.
It's something you feel but can't articulate.
Yes.
Well, you know what, Bethany? The really cool thing is that even if people are listening to this program in solitude, we can all come together and try to come up with more words to describe this feeling. So
yeah.
I'm looking forward to hearing from our listeners about how do you put into one word the feeling of being lonely, but at the same time, okay with that loneliness, actually reveling in it a little bit.
Thank you, Bethany, for bringing up this topic. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me on.
All right. Be well. Take care.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And if you've got a word for Bethany, one you've made or one that you found, let us know, 877-929-9673. Email words at waywardradio.org or talk to us on Twitter at WAYWORD.
Here's a word that was a new one on me, HOGO, H-O-G-O. Do you know this one, Grant?
No. Is that an abbreviation or an acronym?
You would think it would be something very modern, but actually it's a very old word that means stench or a strong or unpleasant smell.
HOGO. Any connections to anything else?
Well, it's connected to French and au goût or high flavor.
Yeah, I guess that's a high flavor. The stench of the sewers is a high flavor indeed.
Yeah. The au goût is originally defined as anything that excites the appetite and is put into sauces like pepper or lemon or something like that. Mm. The word goes back all the way to the 17th century, talking about a really strong flavor or like really gamey meat. But HOGO, it looks like such a modern term to me, but it's not.
The reason I thought of sewers is because the word for sewers is egout, E-G-O-U-T.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
In French?
With an acute accent on the E. Yeah.
Oh, wow. Okay. Well, there you go. Call us with your language question, 877-929-9673. Hi there. You have a way with words.
Hi. This is Michelle in Valdosta, Georgia.
Hey,
and
Michelle.
I really enjoy the show. Thank you. Hi. I hope you don't mind my having a potty mouth on National Public Radio. The word I'd like you to investigate is Doniker, which in circus lingo means a bathroom or any place it serves as such. It's been used for many, many years, going back who knows how long, and I have no idea where the word came from.
Michelle, what got you curious about the word Doniker?
Well, it was a common word that we used every day. I was a circus performer for over 20 years, and that was what it was in circus lingo. I have to go to the Doniker was a common expression. And there's a lot of other words, too, but Doniker seems to be the one that was used most often.
Well, now, wait, you were going to the Doniker between doing what in a circus?
I was what they call generally useful. I was actually on circuses, magic shows, and sideshows. And I have done everything. Generally useful is if they need a pretty girl in an act, you're it. I've had my head cut off. I hung 50 feet in the air doing aerial ballet, no net underneath me in Japan. What else? I was a clown. I was a dancer. I was a choreographer. Just you name it, and I did. I started out as a juggler and rode elephants. What else? Oh, handled snakes, of course. I was Spidora, the spider lady. I had 8 big, very hairy legs. And the funny thing about getting my head chopped off was my sister did an ancestry, and it turns out we're distant relatives of Marie Antoinette.
No.
So it was perfect.
Wow.
I used to get guillotined 8 times a day on the sideshow. But it was a lot of fun.
Oh,
I got to travel and made lots of good friends.
But you also used a Doniker, or you called the restroom the Doniker.
And now you're adding word historian to all those other skills.
Yeah.
Well, that's nice. Yeah, I suppose so.
There are a lot of different spellings for this. Let's just get this down so everyone knows what we're talking about. Doniker is often spelled Doniker, or a double N in the middle.
Right.
Sometimes you'll hear it as Donegan, like the Irish name. Sometimes Dunnigan or Dunnikin or lots and lots of different spellings. But generally, it's believed to have come from two old words meaning dung house, D-U-N-G, house.
Oh.
So it's the place where you put your dung.
Right.
And as a matter of fact, the word dunny, which means privy or outhouse or toilet, and you'll still sometimes hear it in Australia and New Zealand, dunny comes probably from the same origins as Donegan.
Oh, okay.
Or Doniker, yeah.
Well, that makes sense. So, all right.
So, yeah, Doniker came from Dunnikin, and Dunnikin means dunghouse. And there's another word. So dung, the word dung, D-U-N-G, comes from that first part, the dun part. They're related to the same root. And there was an old word, Donna, meaning human fecal matter. And there was a term, the Donna drag. That was the night soil man's cart. He was the fellow who would come around for the contents of your chamber pots. Have you seen the second season of the television show Miracle Workers? There's a Steve Buscemi plays a role on that where he is the night soil man. Well, he comes around with this cart collecting the human waste.
Okay, well, that makes sense then. Because the word that goes along with Doniker is Donication, and we all know what that is.
So. What's a Donication? So where you spend too long in the John on your phone?
That's it.
Michelle.
But we've got a lot of different variations on this word back to the 1700s, and it does show up in the language of circus and carnival workers as early as the 1930s. Although no doubt it's older, because the lingo of circus and carnival workers is this kind of treasured lore that was kept private for a long time until language historians and word historians really started to pay attention to it. And it wasn't well chronicled until the last 120 or 130 years or so.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Yeah. Well, so we're using a fairly old word that has lots of history.
Oh, but you being a part of the circus family is a treasured tradition. You are it's centuries and centuries of lore and folklore and superstition and tradition. You're just a one in a long line of this stuff being passed from person to person. So using Doniker is just one of many things and tales that you could probably tell us that you were a part of.
Definitely. I started in the business as what they call a first of May, somebody brand new, in 1976.
Ooh. A first of May. Ooh. So that's the
first
that's
of
the
May.
Newbie,
that's
right?
Somebody who's, because in the old days, circuses used to go out on the first of May.
Oh, Grant and I are both
scribbling
madly.
If you were new, you were a first of May. Mm-hmm.
I love it.
That's wonderful. Well, Michelle, it has been a delight to talk to you. I do want you to call us anytime you think of something else that you know that everyone would love to hear, okay?
Okay. Well, thank you. Nice talking to you.
You too. Take care and be well.
I really appreciate knowing. That's great. All right.
Yep.
Take care
Don't
now.
Don't house. Bye-bye.
Thanks, Michelle.
You know. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Cheers.
Bye-bye.
Well, we know that Michelle isn't the only one with a rich linguistic history. We know that. So give us a call and tell us about yours. 877-929-9673. Or send your stories about the slang from your corner of the world. The address is words@waywardradio.org. I've been thinking about the word eek. As in to eke out a living or eke out a win. Some people misspell it as E-E-K, but it's actually E-K-E, and you don't see it that much. It's from an old word that means an augmentation or an increase. It comes from Old English eika, meaning addition or supplement, and that makes it a relative of words like auxiliary and augment, a very distant relative of those words. But it also is buried inside another more common English word, which is nickname.
Ah, I thought you were going to get there.
Yeah. Originally, nickname was an eke name, that is an additional name. And then through the process of misdivision, an eke name became a nickname.
So the A-N dropped its N, went from the article A-N to the word eke and became a nickname.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Great example of misanalysis of a word.
I'd love to hear people's nicknames, by the way. We've never really talked much about those. That might be a good call out. What do you think?
Oh, I think it'd be a wonderful one, Gertie.
Okay, Martita. If you've got a clever nickname, what do they call you and why do they call you it? Let us know. We'd love to hear the story. 877-929-9673. Email words@waywardradio.org. You're listening to Away with Words, the show about language and how we use it. I'm Grant Barrett.
And I'm Martha Barnett. There have been many translations of the Old English poem Beowulf over the years, including by some of the greats like J.R.R. Tolkien and Seamus Heaney. But there's a new one by Maria Devana Headley, and Grant, it's nothing short of astonishing.
Ooh.
One reviewer described it as electrifying, and I'd say that's just about right. The poem Beowulf, that's the story of the mighty hero's battle with monsters and a dragon, may have been written as early as the 8th century. Nobody's really sure. But one of Headley's many insights is that this epic tale is one that was meant to be shouted over a bunch of noisy people getting more and more drunk on mead. And so she imagines this poem being told by the old guy sitting at the end of the bar from time to time, pounding his glass and demanding another. In fact, if you read Old English, you know that it often has this kind of pounding, straightforward rhythm. It's marked by lots and lots of alliteration. And it's very down-to-earth language. It's not cerebral. Somebody once compared Old English poetry to the sound of a sack of potatoes being emptied. And it also has the occasional poetic kenning that we've talked about before, like referring to blood as battle sweat or the sun as the sky candle. And Headley synthesizes all this with language that's modern and inventive. She really creates something new. She does it in a way that I can't really describe, except to say that what she does with Beowulf is sometimes like what Lin-Manuel Miranda did with Hamilton. So her version isn't a strict word-for-word rendering, and there's even the occasional profanity. But as she says, if you're looking for the courtly romance in knights, there are other translations. And let me give you an example. one nagging problem has always been how to translate that first word of the poem, you know, what. And what has been translated as behold, or listen, or attend, and even what ho. Basically, it's a windup that signals that a story is coming. Well, Headley renders this as bro. And it could sound gimmicky, sure, but immediately you can hear this guy at the end of the bar commanding your attention. Because he's saying, bro, I'm about to tell you something amazing. I saw it with my own eyes. And really, the way to enjoy this, in my opinion, is to listen to the audio version of the book. It's read by the actor J.D. Jackson. And I was absolutely captivated.
That sounds amazing, Martha. Oh, we got to put a link to that on the website. But you have to perform for us for a second. You know the first line or so by heart of the original Beowulf, right?
Yeah, I do. I mean, I love the sound of it, but in modern English, it makes no sense. What way garden and yard dogum feud kuniga thrum yefrun. And it goes, you know, it doesn't make sense to the modern ear.
But I can hear the rhythm that you were talking about right away.
Yeah, and the way that she renders that is, bro, tell me we still know how to talk about kings. In the old day, everyone knew what men were. Brave, bold, glory-bound. Only stories now, but I'll sound the Spear-Dane song hoarded for hungry time. So you hear that alliteration too, but ooh, it's thrilling.
So she doesn't go completely modern, but she's got enough of it there that you can engage with both your appreciation of the literary history of the text, but also the modern ear. So you've got the two parts of you kind of engaging at once.
That's exactly right. And the way that she puts it in the introduction, and I know you'll appreciate this, is she says, language is a living thing, and when it dies, it leaves bones. I dropped some fossils here next to some newborns. And
oh, lovely. Right.
That
That's totally it, right?
Yeah, yeah. So she's creating almost this new language. And it's, again, I think about Hamilton, where you are watching the beginning of it and you think, he can't keep this up for 2.5 hours. And 2.5 hours later, you're there in tears because this story has so captivated you. So it's kind of like that.
I might take a different metaphor and describe it as when they're digging in Rome for a new metro or subway, and they come across a villa, a Roman villa from centuries ago, and they're putting something in so modern, and yet they find something so ancient. And it's people living in these old spaces with new ideas.
That's perfect. So I highly recommend that. It's the new translation of Beowulf by Maria Devana Headley.
Lovely. Thank you, Martha. We know we have a lot of readers in our crowd, and we know there are more books published every year than anyone could get to. And we'd love to hear your recommendations. Give us a call, 877-929-9673, or send the links and the titles to us, words@waywardradio.org. Hello, you have a way with words.
Hi, Grant. This is Michelle calling from Michigan.
Hi, Michelle. Welcome to the show.
Hey, Michelle.
Hi, thank you. I was calling because of an expression that I read in my art history textbook. It has to do with the phrase garner the laurels. It was in a passage about daguerreotypes, and one of the inventors had died and the other inventor got all of the credit. And I was just wondering where that phrase came from, and what getting all the credit has to do with leaves. Specifically, they said that one of the inventors died, leaving the other to garner the laurels.
Ah, okay. So the other one, the one who didn't die, got all the credit then, right?
Correct. He even got the type of image named after him.
Oh, right. Okay. That refers to the fact that in ancient Greece, winners of competitions, like athletic competitions, were awarded crowns that were made from the fragrant leaves of bay laurels, you know, just like the bay leaf that you put in your soup. They would have these wreaths of bay leaves, and I'm sure you've seen pictures of them on statues or in illustrations. But we get terms like laureate from that, like Nobel laureate is somebody who's won the laurels, who's won that crown as a prize, or poet laureate. In Italy, laureati are graduates of an educational institution. So it's a reward based on that old tradition of crowning somebody with a crown made out of those leaves specifically.
Wow, that is really cool. That is not where I would have thought, but you're right. I have seen images of that crown that you're talking about.
Uh-huh. And do you know what that crown was called in ancient Greek? This is also really cool.
I do not know.
It was called the Stephanos. And we get a couple of modern English names from that term.
Oh, like Stefan.
Mm-hmm. Stefan, Stephen. Yeah, Stephanie. Yep. Esteban in Spanish. All of those go back to the Greek word for crown.
Wow, how neat.
How cool, right? So the next time you're making soup and you put in a bay leaf, you can think about that etymology.
Well, I will certainly be thinking about that whenever I hear that phrase. Thank you so much for that explanation. Long-time listener, first-time caller.
Oh, that's very nice.
Excellent. Right. Well, we look forward to you being a second-time caller sometime.
Yes, please. And take care of yourself.
I certainly will. Thank you
Bye-bye. So
much. Bye-bye.
Okie doke. Bye-bye.
Hey, we're here to explain those expressions that just don't make sense. 877-929-9673. Or we're here to hear you explain something to us. Words at waywardradio.org.
Hello, you have a way with words.
Hi, my name's Camden. I'm calling from Juneau, Alaska.
Oh, hey, Camden. Welcome.
Hi, what's up?
Well, there's this word. I picked it up sort of by osmosis. The word is gaffle. So the usage of it would be, say you go over to your friend's house, and you want to grab a Coke from the fridge, you know, you might say, hey, friend, I'm going to gaffle a Coke from the fridge. And it's this sort of, I'm going to take this thing, and I'm not really asking permission, but I know that you would tell me yes if I was. You might say snag. Hey, man, you mind if I snag your shovel? But, you know, it's this word gaffle. And I don't really know where it comes from or where the usage of what it means. I picked it up from a D&D group in Anchorage. It's it. Something you guys know about?
Gaffle, so G-A-F-F-L-E?
That would be my guess, yeah.
And you picked it up from a Dungeons & Dragons group. Was it part of a character somebody had built or just in casual conversation?
Oh, yeah, it was just really, I mean, the players, not so much from the game itself. It was the group of people that used the word.
Because there's something particular about this word, and that it tends to be more common in the northeast of the United States and in the east of Canada. So I was just kind of surprised to see it pop up in Alaska. Was anybody in that group from elsewhere in the country?
Yeah. The closest, I would say, is the gentleman from Missouri.
Oh, well, that's not near the northeast, but yeah. And I'm from Missouri, and as far as I know, nobody uses gaffle. But the other thing that interests me is that Alaska is known as has a lot of fishing in it, and gaffle is related to a whole bunch of words that have to do with hooks and hooked poles and forks and other things like that, fork-like implements and hook-like implements, including the word gaff. Gaff is a pole with a hook on it that you use to bring stuff in from the water, to pull fish in from the water. And there's a rather renowned book of etymology by Hensley Wedgwood. What a name that is. Hensley Wedgwood, from 1872. And he points out that all these different languages in Europe, particularly the Germanic and Scandinavian languages, have words for these hooked and forked instruments that seize or hold fast. For example, in Danish and Swedish, they have gaffel, but it's E-L at the end, G-A-F-F-E-L, and it refers to the same nautical gaff tool. So it's spelled gaffel, but it means gaff. And that same word exists in other forms in Germanic and Celtic languages, and it means fork or fork-like tool. So all of these are related. And so that brings us to English, American English, and in the Dictionary of American Regional English, we have as early as 1900, gaffle shows up as a verb meaning to grasp, to seize, to take hold of, to carry, to steal, to swindle, to arrest. And that's what you have. That's, I think, in there we have to seize or to grasp or to steal is kind of what you were doing with your friend's Coke when you show up, or your friend's shovel, right?
Right, exactly, yeah.
It still shows up today. You'll find it in hip-hop lyrics, actually, meaning to rob, to steal, to run a scam, or to be harassed by the police or to be arrested by the police. So this word has multiple lives, not only in phishing and not only in casual slang, but in Black English and in hip-hop language and in street language as well. So it's lived multiple lives over the centuries.
Oh, that's fascinating. I didn't know any of that stuff.
Yeah, so gaff and gaffle are definitely related to this long history of Germanic words. All basically have something to do with seizing, taking, and are related to words having to do with hooked or forked implements or instruments.
Huh. All right. Well, great.
That's pretty cool. And what do you have at the end of your arm? You have a hooked or forked instrument.
Yeah, right. So you're fishing in your friend's fridge.
Right, exactly. All right. Well, thanks for answering my question. I really appreciate you guys.
It's our pleasure.
Yeah, you gaffled an answer.
Take care, Camden. Appreciate the call.
You too. All right. Take
care. Bye-bye.
All right. Bye-bye.
If you'd like us to find the treasure inside of some word that you know, give us a call, 877-929-9673. Email words@waywardradio.org or chat with us on Twitter at WAYWORD.
Here's a rare word that I think is worth reviving. It's simmicky, S-Y-M-M-A-C-H-Y, simmicky.
So does that first part have something to do with symmetry?
It has to do with togetherness, for sure.
Togetherness, okay. And to make something together, does that last part have something to do with making? I don't know.
It has to do with fighting, because in ancient Greek, mache is to fight. And so a logomachy, for example, is a verbal argument.
Oh, but, right. Of course.
Yeah. Simmicky is based on a word that the ancient Greeks had for an alliance in war. And it's not used that often. When it is used, it's used in a political sense of, you know, countries having a simmicky. You know, they have an alliance to fight against something else. But I think it could be used more generally. You know, why not have a simmicky with other people, an alliance against a common enemy?
Oh, so you could have an alliance, say, against pollution from a factory down the river, or an alliance against trash along the beach or something like that.
Yeah, anything that's threatening your well-being.
Very good. Simmicky. I like the S-Y-M-M-A-C-H-Y.
Very good. And another word in this family of fighting words is skiomachy, which comes from the Greek word for shadow. So skiomachy is shadow boxing.
Oh, I love the sound of that. That one's just fun to say.
Right?
Skiomachy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
877-929-9673.
Hello, you have a way with words.
Hi. Calling you from La Jolla, Max Jennings.
Hi, Max. Welcome to the show. What's up?
Hi,
Thank
Max.
You. I've been doing volunteer work at the San Diego Humane Society for about 3 or 4 years, and in adoptions. And unfortunately, about 2 years ago, we lost our Cocker Spaniel to cancer.
Oh.
So we waited about 4 or 5 months, and then I was at work, and one of my colleagues said, "Have you seen Ben?" So I go in to see Ben, and this gorgeous, falling in love immediately dog comes over to me and puts his two front paws up on my lap, and I look down at him, and he just wants to lick me and give me kisses and what have you. And he turns sideways, and I see something kind of unusual about his mouth. So I finally got him to hold still enough, and there is this snaggle tooth, it's called, on the lower left-hand side that wraps, goes out of his mouth and comes up over his upper lip. Where does the term snaggle tooth come from? Where did it originate?
It makes sense if you know that the root of snaggletooth is simply snag, which in the 16th century meant a stump of a tree or a branch, something that's been like a short, jagged projection, a tree branch that's been broken off. And later on, you get the idea of a tree or a branch in the water that maybe causes a snag when your boat is going in the water. So,
okay.
Yeah,
and so I was thinking, you know, maybe it was something like this, something that caught on something. Like if you're wearing a sweater and you're walking by a bush or a tree and it snags on that, and that's the only thing I could think of.
Right, that's the same idea. Yeah, you have that little tooth projecting that same way.
Ah, okay. Well, thank you for letting me know that. I never thought of it kind of like that angle.
Well, Max, it sounds like you both lucked out. So thank you for your work with the Humane Society, and thank you for calling.
Thank you for your stories. You've warmed our hearts. Take care of yourself and the dog, all right?
Thank you, folks. Have a great day.
All righty. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
877-929-9673. Thanks to senior producer Stephanie Levine, editor Tim Felton, and production assistant Rachel Elizabeth Weisler.
You can send us messages, subscribe to the podcast and newsletter, and catch up on hundreds of past episodes at waywardradio.org.
Our toll-free line is always open in the U.S. and Canada, 877-929-9673, or email us words@waywardradio.org.
Away with Words is an independent production of Wayward Inc., a nonprofit supported by listeners and organizations who are changing the way the world talks about language.
Many thanks to Wayward board member and our friend Bruce Rogo for his help and expertise.
Thanks for listening. I'm Grant Barrett.
And I'm Martha Barnett. Until next time, goodbye.
Bye-bye.
DJ Heim from Forest, and you're listening to 88.3 WRCT.
WRCT, Pittsburgh. I'm gonna go get some more. WRCT, Pittsburgh.
WRCT, Pittsburgh.
This is Brad Keselowski, driver number two, Discount Tire Ford Mustang. Racing fans know that a quick pit stop to check the tires can give me the winning edge. The same is true for your car. Proper tire tread helps keep traction on the road and everyday driving. To check your tread, simply insert a penny, Lincoln's head first, into your tire grooves. If you can see all of Honest Abe's head, it's time to get your tires checked by a professional.
A message from the U.S. Tire Manufacturers Association.
Hey there, folks. Glad you could join me for all the best, the smoothest of the smooth, the cool and gentle sounds of what we call jazz.
Tired of the fluffy stuff? At WRCT Pittsburgh, jazz is a wholesome
Welcome to the Best of Counterspin for 2021. I'm Janine Jackson. We call it the Best of, but this annual roundup is just a reflection of the kinds of conversations we hope have offered a voice or context or information that might help you interpret the news you read. We are thankful to all of the activists, researchers, reporters, and advocates who've appeared on the show. They help us see the world more clearly and see the role we can play in changing it. You're listening to the Best of Counterspin for 2021, brought to you by the Media Watch Group FAIR. While it came in the midst of a calamitous time, the year's beginning was marked historically by an event we're still accounting for, the January 6th Capitol insurrection. We talked with activist, attorney, and executive director of the Partnership for Civil Justice Fund, Mara Verheiden-Hilliard, on January 7th.
I think what we witnessed yesterday, in addition to being an extraordinary event in U.S. history and our lifetimes, is fully defining of what has been told to us over and over again is the neutral application of law enforcement and law and order. Any of us who have ever demonstrated in Washington, D.C. know full well the capacity of the police agencies here to shut down and repress completely peaceful protest. I mean, our clients and we have been subject to kettling, to mass arrest, to projectile weapons, to being soaked in chemical weapons, to tear gas. And there's been no hesitation to use this. The police have all the materiel, the riot gear, the personnel, the weapons, the tactics at their disposal. So that can lead us only to the most obvious conclusion, which is what happened yesterday at the nation's capital could not happen unless the police allowed it to happen. So we are demanding an investigation because there has to be exposure and accountability for every single officer, for every single command official, for everyone who was involved in allowing, facilitating this white supremacist mob violence. Our point here is not calling for police repression. Our goal is not to increase police repression. What we need to do and must do here is expose the nature of police repression, and that is so evident here today.
Much rightful attention was directed at the Supreme Court's thinking around Roe versus Wade, which affirmed abortion rights. But reproductive justice has always been about much more than Roe or abortion. That's a floor, not a ceiling, as Kimberly Inez McGuire, executive director of the group Urge, Unite for Reproductive and Gender Equity, explained.